Buongiorno, everyone.
Oh, we're being very clever today.
Well, what is the subject today?
The subject is Italian cooking. What's everybody's favorite cuisine in the universe, just about, probably?
Apparently, yeah. Anyhow, it's On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and today we're going to be talking to people who have written rather spectacular, I would say, cookbooks on Italian cuisine.
We have four splendid exponents of Italian cooking.
I like all of them.
Each with a different point of view.
Right.
And all sure to please with their conversation and also with their books, which you might very well want to go out and buy once you've heard them talking to us. So let's get started with Mark Vetri.
Who we adore.
Of Philadelphia. Yeah, we adore him. So do most people in the United States. A lot of people in Italy too. Many say that he's the best Italian chef in the United States, which is pretty remarkable considering he was born here. But he spends a lot of time over there, as we do.
And he trained there too.
Yeah, and it's always such a great pleasure to talk to him.
I guess there's more than a little pressure on you, Mark Vetri, since everybody calls you the best Italian chef in the United States.
Huh.
Does that make you nervous?
A little bit. It definitely makes me a little bit nervous. You know, they walk in with very high expectations.
So. Well, now, I mean, we use your first cookbook, Il Viaggio di Vetri, constantly.
Oh, good.
And I expect that this one will be the same thing. I've never seen so many enticing recipes that actually are explained so well. They're easy to do.
Oh, thank you.
This one's called Rustic Italian Food. And I guess there's some people who would say that most Italian food is rustic. How do you define it?
I mean, a lot of it is. I like to look at it like the first one was really the restaurant, where
right.
You know, everybody wanted like the recipes from Vetri. You know?
Uh-huh.
So I had to write that one.
Like as if they were going to be able to make them, right?
It is a little harder that one, and there were a lot of emails and a lot of writing about how to make them work. So this one,
you wanted a quiet life, right?
So I wanted to go a little bit easier with this one. I actually wanted, you know, to make things that yes, we can we're to make in the restaurants, but you're also able to make them in your home.
You know, now these are beautiful children pictured.
Yes,
there.
They are.
Aren't they gorgeous?
I think so. I'm sort of biased.
Well, you know, when we were in Osteria once, we saw you and your family.
I was. Yeah, we.
You were all there.
We eat there on usually Sunday night, because we live near there. So
I remember them being much younger, but I guess they were. It was a while ago.
Yeah, they're still young, you know, five, three.
It's probably a good thing to note right here, Mark, that in fact, if these recipes are a lot like the cuisine at Osteria. So the good news for those people who actually would like the book, but the last thing they want to do is try to cook something from it. That's okay, because you can always go to Osteria in
Philadelphia. Exactly, yeah. You know, I would actually say a lot of them are actually from Osteria and also from Amice. A lot of them.
And you're opening up a new one?
Yes, right near the Osteria. It's called Albina.
Yeah, and what is that?
This one's more like the Italy the version of the gastropub.
Oh, okay.
A lot of things like that on there.
What does alla spina mean?
That means actually from the beer tap. You know?
Okay, because I knew it meant something.
So when you're in Italy, you know, you say una birra alla spina.
Okay.
That just means give me a beer from the beer tap.
You see, I never ordered beer in Italy.
You never ordered beer. But if you ordered beer, you would. So that's going to be a lot of fun.
Well, you have a lot of explaining in this book. A lot of how we describe it, you really are trying to teach people.
You know,
informational.
Well, I just thought I love to make the salumis, and I was always looking for some way to understand them. And I, whenever there was the new books out, I would get them, but they were always missing a little bit. So we had to really learn on our own. We went to Italy a lot.
That's tough.
We worked in a lot of the sausage houses there, and over the 8-9 years, we were able to make all of the mistakes, and we were able to learn. So when I wrote this, I really wanted to share that knowledge.
You share something very interesting and very important, and you explain why. And this is typical of what's in the book. So you write about sampling a soprasetta, I think, in Bergamo or Bergamo,
sure,
however you pronounce it, that was only a few days old.
Oh, yeah. And that's my favorite thing ever, eating just like really young salumi. I mean, you're rarely, that's just not, you're never going to find it anywhere.
But you can make, but you can make it for yourself.
Sure you can.
So that was the point I was making. So here you are, you tried this in Italy, and then you said, now I'm making my own salumi, why don't I see how mine is? And I guess you must have made quite a lot of it, because you kept on saying, well, I'll open another one, I'll cut into another
one. We make a lot. Well, we actually make it for all of the restaurants.
Uh-huh.
So we usually make it once a week, once every other week, but that's enough for all of the restaurants.
But it's a great excuse when you cut into it, then, of course, you have to finish off the rest of it, right?
Oh, it's just so like, yummy. And it's amazing.
Well, you know, you have some rather unusual recipes in here. I mean, on one hand, you delve really deeply into the details, explaining about making bread, the kinds of flours, and so forth,
sure,
and also the different kinds of pastas. You go through the difference between extruded and fresh, and
sure,
and this wheat and that wheat, so these are all the basic things. But then you also turn it around, and you have some really unusual, what I think most people expect in an Italian cookbook, unusual recipes in here. This is not unusual, but it's one of my favorite things, the orchietti with veal ragu and bitter greens. I love that.
Yeah, well, that's, yeah. I mean,
that's on it.
I mean, a lot of them in there are very, very simple ragus and things. I just wanted, I think, everyone to understand or to have a really nice foundation. Once you have that, once you understand the basics, you can make anything. You can marry things with other things. You can make different shapes.
And there are millions to make.
But you have to understand the basics first. That a lot of even line cooks nowadays, they don't. Thought it would really be nice to start there.
Now, how did you learn it yourself? I mean, for those people
who are too lazy
to go back and listen to the interview that you did with us before.
I just worked and learned. I actually never went to a culinary school, and that's just me. You know, there's nothing wrong with it. Never went to any of them. And I just worked and learned and, you know, sort of hopped from restaurant to another restaurant and then to Los Angeles, and I worked for Wolfgang out there, and then I went to Italy, and I just kind of delved into it.
But no, there's something about this. You're doing really good Italian food, and yet definitely a Mark Vetri in all these recipes.
I guess. I mean, I don't know.
I mean, what separates you from the millions of other chefs that cook with Italian food?
I don't know. We just, we look at the, and like in all of the guys who quit with me and, you know, who last, you know, we all sort of think the same. For me, there are just certain things that work. And I can almost look at something that someone makes, and I don't even have to eat it, and I just know whether or not it's going to be nice or not. And that's not only me. I mean, I think that a lot of chefs who have been working in this industry for a while, they can also do that. It's just, you know, you just know what you like, you know what works, and you just use your instincts.
Somebody who was a fan of Osteria,
mm-hmm,
who I think I can sell this artichoke mostarda recipe to.
Oh, God. And
is that complicated to make?
It is not, because you know what? I've gotten probably 20 emails over the last month thanking me for the recipe, and they all have a photo.
Oh, no, really?
of what they made. So it works, and everyone's making that. That's actually one of the items in there that I think everyone's making.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is
that is the liver rigatoni.
Liver rigatoni. I must have missed that one. That's going to be something for Peter. He loves his liver.
That's an Osteria dish that's kind of like well-known, so to speak, and everyone's been waiting for the
Really?
So you did give a few secrets away, huh?
We give a lot. We give all the secrets. You know, there are none. There aren't any secrets. Whatever you want to know. I mean, if there's, like, something you eat at the restaurant and the next morning you email me and say, hey, you know, would you mind sending me the recipe for this? Yeah. No.
There is one secret. That's called how you managed to snag a reservation at Vetri's.
Well, that one's a little harder. You know, the other restaurants are a little bit larger.
I heard your father couldn't get in on his birthday.
No, he can always get. He doesn't want to go there on his birthday. He wants to eat red sauce.
Does he really?
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Well, I bet you don't get a whole bunch of people doing the whole suckling pig.
Not a lot, no.
We've done a million of them.
We do so many of those.
Peter and I, for some reason, have always been in situations where they're planning on roast whole suckling pig and nobody knows how to make it except us. So
well,
we've done it in pits. We've done it in a stone oven.
Yeah.
There's
another recipe, you know.
Everybody seems to have confidence in my ability to be able to cook things outdoors.
There you go. Well,
so I get left to be in control. I've never really... I don't know why I encourage
you. Never
asked
for it, but it just happened.
That's exactly right.
I know.
So now, I never pay that much attention to desserts. Are they popular in these restaurants?
Oh, sure they are. Yeah.
So I don't eat desserts, so I never did.
Oh, really?
I'm looking here, you candied hazelnuts, which are...
Oh, doing. Yeah, we have a lot of desserts. We love desserts, just love them. And we make, I think, a different style one for each of the restaurants, like Amisa's really rustic ones. Those three, they're a little bit more refined. And then obviously Vetri is their... They're very refined, but there's a mixture of them in the book. The ones that are in there, but they're more for the home cook, so they're a little bit more of the Amisa style desserts.
Well, I think people, they love this Puntarella stuff, but you can't get the real Puntarella.
You can if you really look. Some of the
people
farmers
give me stuff
are...
And it's not Puntarella, it's not the same.
It's not, but you can find it if, like, you really look. Like, there are some farmers up in, like, New York who are making an effort.
Well, no, I've had it from farmers markets called Puntarella, and it's just not what you get in Rome. First of all, it's the wrong time of the year. They're picking it in August. And
sure. It's a little thicker, and it's a little bit heavier, so you have to kind of cook it a little more, whereas in the other one you can eat raw.
Well, no. You seem to be really very pleased about this new restaurant, the beer place you're opening.
Oh, I love it. It's
why are you so crazy about that?
I don't know. It's just going to be a lot of... When we went to last, there was a lot of those style restaurants there where, you know, they had a whole lot of beers that were on tap, and they had awesome little snacks, and then if you wanted to order a little bit more, they had really nice staffs, and then they had some whole animals that you could order, and it was just really kind of fun to eat that way. Nothing like I've ever really seen here in America.
Yeah, I haven't seen them.
Yeah, so
I'll have to look for them next time.
I mean, this is going to be really fun and really interesting, and you know, just kind of something new, not the same old. Which is always nice. You just have to kind of reach and see what's out there.
I even like your cover here with the fabas.
That's a great cover.
Wow.
We all like that. I think it's really rare that the writer and publishing house like the same things.
But, it's beautiful. Well,
they showed us that the photo, and we loved it right away. It's actually lima beans on there.
Oh, are those limas?
Fava, yes, it is.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's more, you can get fabulous in this. Well, I think that I'm going to use this book a lot, and
oh,
I think that, that everyone else will too. And
I hope so.
It's not just your run-of-the-mill. It might be comfort food, and it might be rustic, but it has that extra polish that you have that comes from your talent, Mark.
Oh, thank you so much.
And thank you so much for talking to us. And,
my pleasure.
I wish you'd come cook for me today.
I would love to. Just let me know when.
Okay.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Mark. Good luck with your new restaurant.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Our next guest is what you might call a permanent resident. And On the Menu Radio, I guess Lydia Bastianich has been with us five, six, seven times. Always with a wonderful new story to tell about beloved Italy and the cooking thereof. In this case, a new book about a rather interesting subject, which is Italian cooking the American way.
In America.
So it's a whole set of recipes dedicated to and obtained from people who made their home here in the United States, couldn't necessarily find all the foods of Italy, but certainly found some substitutes and created an Italo-American cuisine which is unique and extraordinarily satisfying in its own right. So here's Lydia Bastianich.
We always enjoy talking to Lydia Bastianich, and we always have something new to talk to her about because she is a prolific cookbook writer and even actually now a children's story writer and, of course, a PBS star. Lydia, welcome to On the Menu, and I have to say that Lydia's Italy in America is just so exciting as a new book. You can explain what the subject is, but I wanted to start out by saying you must have had a role on this tour, traveling all over the United States looking at Italian-American communities, because there are plenty of pictures of you and your daughter Tanya in groups, smiling and looking very happy.
Yes, and you know, I had a grand time, really, discovering, if you will, the Italy in America.
Right.
It took me 3 years to pull this book together, and just because I've always brought to my restaurants, or still do, to my books, to my television series, Italy, the authentic food of Italy in Italy. And here in America, there is, of course, ever more this authentic food, but there is the whole Italian-American element of food.
You have an interesting perspective on it, since you yourself are an Italian immigrant to America.
Well, yeah, I am Italian. I came here at 12, and I am an Italian immigrant. I am a sort of the immigrant, not the first generation, but just I am the immigrant.
Uh-huh.
And so it was quite evident, even though I was young, as I got older and as I got into food, it was evident to me the differences between the Italian food cooked in America and the Italian food that came from Italy. And the two, a lot of times, got mixed up. And the denial of one, oh, that's not really Italian, or that really is Italian. But that's not the case. Two different cuisines.
Yes.
It represents two different countries, two different parts of people's lives. One is the authenticity of what is Italy, its land, its climate, its topology, or whatever. The other one is the story of the immigrants, these Italian immigrants coming to a country, finding different products, and creating a cuisine or cooking a cuisine based on what they remembered, but with new products.
Yes, and tell me how much you learned in the process of researching this book. I mean, were you surprised by anything in particular?
Well, what I was surprised, Anne, was how much the Italian Americans held to their Italian heritage. I'm talking about three, four generations that were here. They still claim the Italian heritage. They still cook those Italian dishes that their great grandmother cooked, and they're so proud. And they make sure that this is the history of my family. These are the flavors, and it's amazing. It's wonderful. It's beautiful to see the respect and the pride that, for all purpose sake, these are American people now, four generations, hold in being someplace down the line.
Now, didn't they keep their regional identity of Italy when they came here? Like, did they stay Calabrian, or did they stay Friulian like yourself?
In
or did they stay
cases,
like Tuscans, or did they stay like Sicilians?
In most cases, those initial immigrants came in, if you will, packed from their own region. And I guess that was security. They left as a group. They thought maybe that in unity, their strength, and they did come. For example, the Sicilians, you know, the three major ports of entry for the immigrants at the end of the 1800s and the beginning of the 1900s, for Italian immigrants were New York, of course, Philadelphia, and New Orleans.
Yeah, that surprised me. I mean, I found this out with John Besh's The Cookbook Before Last, and we interviewed him. He has a whole section on Sicilian food.
Exactly. So because New Orleans was, I guess, a cheaper port to go to, it offered jobs. You have the whole Gulf fishing. Sicilians are fishermen. They're, you know, island people. And they found jobs and food, and they settled. So this strong influence when I went to New Orleans, and the remnants of what you will of the Italian culture still being vibrant, the mofoletta sandwich. It's one of those Sicilian sandwiches that I guess workers took to when they went to work their land. And what they did, you know, because Italians always, they need their vegetables. And they always preserved or cured or dried legumes and vegetables so that they would have it for the winter. Canned their tomatoes, pickled their olives, and made jardiniera. You know, different vegetables were pickled when they were in season so that in the winter time they would have them. And so this great sandwich for the men going out and working their fields is this bread with cold cut, prosciutto, whatever, and all this pickled vegetables,
right,
jardiniera, olives, all of that sort of chopped up and put in with the meat. And this is what the mofoletta sandwich is now in New Orleans.
Yes.
It's great. They call it olive salad.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, the bread is like a big hamburger bun, a bigger one, wider one with sesame seed, very Sicilian. The bread with sesame seed actually came from the Arab war in Sicily. So to find it 4 or 5 generations later still going strong and one of New Orleans' favorite is traced to Sicily.
Yeah. Now, what about California? That's another whole.
California.
San Diego and San Francisco, right?
Right. The whole of California offered so much opportunity for the immigrants. Let's begin way north in the Napa and Sonoma.
Oh,
now,
yeah.
That's wine country now, but some of the first settlers were from Trentino Alto Adige, wine producers, Swiss colony, the Swiss colony, you know, up Trentino is near Switzerland.
Right.
And they came, and what was planted before by cornfields and different vegetables, they began, they saw this wonderful hills with a great climate, you know, this almost like in northern Italy, for planting vines. And they did, and it was successful. And so on, slowly they brought in their paisanis. Then the Piemontese got wind of it. Piemonte is the other sort of big wine region of Italy. So there's a lot of Piedmontese and Tuscans up there because the opportunity of growing vines and making wine, it was very conducive. But not only that, the opening of this as a wine country, the Bank of America, let's say, Giannino was one of the wine.
Yeah, he sounds a little Italian, huh?
Yes.
Well, he was the founder's. I don't know if you ever knew that.
No,
he
I didn't.
Was what?
I was just remembering for Anne that Giannino was the founder and president of Bank of America.
Exactly. So he was from San Francisco, and he saw this influx of immigrants, Italian immigrants. And even though he was a first-generation American, and he realized he began to give small business loans to these vintners. And his heritage had a big deal, much to do with it, to trust these people because he knew that his parents came from a culture that made wine and made it successfully. And so grew the wine country and so grew Bank America by making loans to small businesses.
Just as a funny aside, Lydia, a lot of people don't know this, and maybe you do, maybe you don't, but Greystone, the Culinary Institute of America place in St. Helena,
yes,
that used to be the Italian Swiss colony building.
That's right. That's right. They had it up, and they started up, and then they grew so much that they came down. That's a beautiful building.
It's a magnificent building. I can remember drinking Italian Swiss colony wine when I first came here as an alternative to Gallo.
I don't think I
did.
I think it went away. Now, what were some of the unique food of that part of California that came from Italy?
Well, San Francisco. San Francisco, the Ligurians, you know, Ligurian, there's 20 regions of Italy, and if you look at Italy, you know, I call the armpits, but on the left side, that's Liguria, and Liguria where the pesto is. but Cioppino, the fisherman.
Okay, I was wondering about that because a lot of people would trace that to Boulabaisse, which is Marseille in France, but it's really it's really different. So it's like a Ligurian sailor soup.
It is. The Cioppino is, you know, you go to Liguria, you still find the Cioppino. They might think in San Francisco that it is their own, but that is rooted in the Ligurian immigrants there. And they still cook it, and they, you know, it's a big part of what the San Francisco menu is. But then, if you travel down, and we're always in California, the Salina Valley, the great sort of valley where you get two harvests, up to three harvests of vegetable a year, the garlic, the artichokes, broccoli di rape, hundreds of miles of planted fields of these vegetables. I mean, they couldn't be more Italian, these vegetables, and yet they have become such a big part of the American table. Take, for example, broccoli di rape. The Andy Boy family, four generations ago, grandpa, coming from Italy, needed to bring his broccoli, so he brought the seeds for himself. But now it is a multi-million-dollar industry, and it has changed the way Americans eat. Just about everybody knows broccoli rape.
Yes, and then you're going to talk a little bit about the canning empires that were built, the fish canneries.
Right. And so going down the coast, San Diego, Santa Monica, the Pacific coast is a great coast for bluefish, sardines. They travel from way down Santa Monica and San Diego all the way up to Seattle to mate and to... So the sardines are really... And the tuna, the bluefish, is quite available. And Sicily is known for its tonare, for its canning of tuna, for its canning of sardines. And so when they came to the coast, it was a great opportunity for them, that business. The canning industry in San Diego, which now has been moved, was really energized and kind of blossomed when the Italian immigrants were there. Then it went into the Asian immigrants took over. And now it somehow has subsided, the canning, I think, done actually on the boats out at sea. And, you know, the fish couldn't be any fresher. You just can out there and it's ready to go. But gave jobs and opportunities for a new life to thousands of immigrants. And it created an industry and a business.
And we have Ghirardelli, chocolate. The chocolate, what's it called?
Yeah, you pronounce that one really well.
I can't remember what it is.
Ghirardelli.
Ghirardelli.
Oh, Ghirardelli in San Francisco.
Exactly.
That's another family in the chocolate. But take, for example, the Progresso. That's going back to New Orleans. As we were talking, the Sicilians need their canned vegetables and tomatoes. They need them nice and ripe, and if it's not in the summer, then they'll use the canned ones in the winter. And so the Progresso family decided to begin canning the tomatoes for their immigrant compatriots, if you will. And the Progresso company was born. Now it's a mega company. I think it's owned by General Mills.
Probably is now. Now back to that other Italian colony on the East Coast called New Jersey.
Yes.
What's happening there? What was unique to that area?
Well, New York and New Jersey and Philadelphia, by hundreds of thousands of immigrants came. And what New Jersey offered while first coming into the city and sort of finding jobs at the docks or building streets or building bridges, but slowly, you know, Italians are farmers at heart, growing vegetables and food was ingrained in them. And they found the fields of New Jersey, and that's still till this day. For example, Maggiore Farms, one of the biggest, we went to visit it, one of the biggest farms in New Jersey, the plum tomatoes, eggplant, and this is third generation. And, you know, we went there. We went to visit because we wanted to know tribes and why did they want. A mom was still there, the second generation, and boy, we had a spread. Just, I could have been in Italy.
Ah.
And the eggplants and the tomatoes and the mozzarella and the prosciutto. And, oh, it was just wonderful to be in their midst, and to see how the family as a whole, and they're one of the largest produce purveyors in Jersey. And also, what amazed me, breweries, which are in New Jersey, it's one of the sort of, I think it's Hellberg, I'll find out for you exactly the town. It is the capital of blueberries in America. Now, blueberries are really American. They're not Italian. But the Italian family is the king of blueberries, and they grow the largest amount.
Isn't that amazing, huh? So they learned to grow something that they traditionally didn't know anything about.
Italians are genetically great farmers.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Italians, they love to eat well. They love to eat in season. And they will find a way to modify anything so it is perfect and good. Now, you know, berries are very much part of the Italian culinary repertoire. So blueberries is not that. They're in the berry family.
Right, sure.
And it was natural to make it their own.
Well, there's so many of these communities. Providence is another one. In Pittsburgh, we shouldn't ignore Pittsburgh.
Absolutely, Pittsburgh. You know, they came up to Pittsburgh for the steel workers, the work in the steel, the railroads, and so on. And Pittsburgh up on the hill. What is that?
Bloomfield.
Bloomfield, exactly.
Literally.
We visited there, and, you know, the Dell's restaurant, all that's still very Italian. But Premonti, take example. I featured the Premonti sandwich. I thought that was an amazing sandwich.
Oh, it is amazing. Do you know Mario loves this, too? Mario loves Premontis.
Yeah. Well, but, you know, I think the provola and the capicolas, you know, that's very Italian in a sandwich, yeah. Absolutely. And then the throwing in of the French fries, very American, you know. So you see the two cultures converge, if you will, on the plate.
The thing you also talk about is that there is this sense of community, that there are all these Italian-American clubs all over the country.
There are, and still, you know, they still sort of practice and celebrate the old tradition, because in Italy still the sagre, they're called, or the celebration of a season or the celebration of a saint, Saint Joseph.
Oh yeah, we have a place here. I don't know if you ever got to that. They have the second largest Persepia or whatever.
I went to visit with those ladies.
Oh,
I did. I made the keys. I have them in my book. I have them on. I taped them, and they were. I mean, 2-3 weeks in advance. Working towards the St. Joseph's feast. And the beauty of it, you know, and I said, why are you doing this? We're Americans. He says, no, that's very important. That holds the family together. It gives us identity. It makes us feel very part of something bigger than ourselves. And then at the end, they said, you know, it's very important for the children to feel that. But then at the end, all of these goodies and all of that were sold to benefit the needies.
Uh-huh.
So it was, absolutely. It was wonderful because Pittsburgh has great history of Italian. Penn Mac on Penn Avenue.
Yes, the Sanseri.
All the espressos, absolutely.
You see trucks in Sicily with the Sanseri name on it. I mean, it's a very Sicilian family.
Yeah, Sanseri, sure. Sure.
So what do you think is going to happen down the line, Lydia? Like in our case, first I married an Englishman.
Yeah.
Okay. Then our son, who was by this time only half Italian, married a woman from a Polish-German background, and they cook chili and they cook all these other things, but nobody does the traditional Polish food in their family. Nobody does the traditional Italian food when they're cooking. I mean, what happens to the next generation?
Well, why don't we make some? We're going down there for Thanksgiving. Why don't we just make some?
But my mother made it. I never made any of this stuff.
Well, it doesn't mean we can. We'll have to take Lydia's book. There's sure to be a recipe we can fix.
Well, okay, we will do that.
Hey, Lydia, what a pleasure it is to talk to you, as always. Thank you so much for joining us, and don't be a stranger.
No, okay. Thank you very much.
Oh, Lydia, yeah, and let's mention the name again, because it's filled with interesting facts and fabulous recipes. Let's not forget that. More than 175 recipes, which your cover calls Lovely Lusty. But it's the stories also of all the people in it. And as I said, you look so happy amidst them all, smiling ear to ear.
Thank you. I had a great time going across America, discovering Italy.
Lydia's Italy in America is the title. Lydia Bastianich, we love you. Thank you.
Thanks, Anne. Bye-bye.
Bye.
We're going to go to another break right now, but Anne had better come in after the break, I think, because I forgot to say welcome back. Because I'm not practiced at the art of bringing us back after a break. But Anne will do that the next time. In the meantime, here are messages for you.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, I think I'm told now that I'm supposed to say welcome back, so I will. Next up is a book you may find almost indispensable. If you like pasta, well, I mean, there's pasta, and then there's pasta, and there is, as you hear, talking or listening to our next guest, glorious pasta. Buongiorno, Domenica Marchetti. Come sta?
Bene, grazie. Hi.
Hi, you. And boy, you are prolific. We were scheduled to talk about your, what I thought was your latest book, The Glorious Pasta of Italy, which is a beauty of a book. And then I got another one, which we'll mention, called Rustic Italian out of Williams-Sonoma. And then how many other books have you written?
I have written two other books. So, yes, I have two books that came out this year, which I can't even believe it. I sometimes feel like somebody else wrote them. They kind of happened in a dream. But my first book was The Glorious Soups and Stews of Italy, which came out in 2006. And that was followed by Big Night In, which is kind of a casual Italian entertaining book, and that came out in 2008.
Right. Now, you have some really impressive endorsements on this Glorious Pasta book. Michael Chiarello and Giuliano Hazan and Kathy Wims, who we actually just, we were just at Nostrano, what, a month ago and interviewed her?
Yeah, we were in Poland. She really is terrific.
Yeah, I was at her restaurant, I guess, in 2010 when I was in Portland, but we had actually met at a food professional conference, and she was the first chef to tell me that she actually cooked from my soup and stew book in her restaurant, and I was so over the moon to hear that, and we hit it off from the beginning. And so when we sent out advanced copies of the book, I wanted her to see it, because just because I know she has a real appreciation for Italian cuisine.
Now, and her food is really excellent.
Yummy.
Yeah, I love the photo on the inside of the front of the book, which is five forks and an empty dish with some sauce staining, which obviously held pasta. That's sort of the way it goes, doesn't it?
It is, and the photos in this book were shot by Franz Rufinach, who's an award-winning photographer, and she just captured the tone of this book so beautifully. I write the manuscript, and I create all the recipes, and I send it off, and then, to me, the magic happens, and it gets designed and laid out and photographed, and I just speechless when I saw the book. It's just so beautiful.
Isn't it gorgeous? Yes, it's absolutely magnificent. It makes me want to go rushing out to make some pasta.
Good.
Now, here's the funniest thing, though, because we've been in Italy lots of times, and we've noticed that around about 5 or 6 o'clock in the evening when the shops reopen, one of the very popular shops to go to is a place that makes homemade pasta, except it's made in a shop.
Yeah.
And it seems like when anybody tells us who's cooking pasta, it's always grandma. Nonna is cooking pasta on Sunday at lunchtime, probably 3 or 4 different kinds. But during the week, Italians are so busy, they just go to the pasta shop. Now,
don't you feel like
a little bit of a throwback?
I actually don't. I know these shops have proliferated, and the last few times I was there, when I was at friend's house, they actually would get pasta from the pastificio. But times change, and Italian women are working, and as simple as making a batch of fresh pasta actually is, it still is a little time-consuming when you work. Although I have to say, in testing this book, I got to the point where I could literally throw together a batch of egg noodles starting at 5:30 and still have dinner on the table by 7 or 7:30. It's really that easy, and that's one of the things I wanted people to understand. I think they still get intimidated by the idea of making fresh pasta, and instead, it's one of the most pleasurable experiences. And you don't have to do it every day. You can reserve it for a Sunday or a weekend. But it's just such a wonderful project. And I think kind of at a stage in this country where people are willing to experiment. We have some good cooks. I keep hearing about young people cooking. And I think that people are ready to tackle this kind of thing.
So you think your book is really timely?
I hope so, yeah.
I'm sure it is.
Well, it's so packed with information, that, and it goes beyond what most people would think of as one of these books on pasta. Just in different levels, too, of complications or sophistications, I guess I should call it. But reading down here like this, list of contents, you have equipment, ingredients, selecting, cooking, and saucing dried pasta, and it goes all the way through here with the specific recipes. You also have categories, things like pasta and soup, pasta with sauce, baked pasta. Some of these things that people wouldn't ever think of when they think of pasta, if they think of just a spaghetti on a plate with meatballs or something. You have classics, though, which I thought was an interesting section. And then the other one that I wanted to talk to you about, too, was the showstoppers. You even have dessert pasta, which I have to say, I've had Greek dessert pasta, but never Italian.
Yes, and I like to end my, we'll start there with the desserts and
okay.
I guess work back, but I like to end my books on a sweet note. When I wrote The Glorious Soups and Stews of Italy and I was done testing the recipes, I thought to myself, well, I can't end with a stew. And so that book was organized seasonally, and what I ended up doing was just making four seasonal crostate, sweet tarts, one for fall, winter, spring, and summer. And I just put those into the book, even though they were neither a soup nor a stew. And so when it came time to end the pasta book, I'm really not a gimmicky cook. I don't like gimmicks. I'm a home cook through and through. But I know that I had cicerchiata, which is basically little fried pasta dough balls that are tossed in honey and then formed into a ring. And so it's kind of a broader definition of pasta, but it is pasta really just means dough. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to do a very small dessert section, and I think I said in the intro of that section, if I'm going to have pasta for dessert, let it be fried. That's what I did. And I really loved ending on that sweet note. Classics Worth Keeping was another chapter that I felt compelled to include. These are things that recipes that many Americans are familiar with, spaghetti with clam sauce, red clam sauce and white clam sauce, stuffed shells, which I have to say I never ate growing up. My mother never made them because she was born and raised in Italy, and so she never cooked Italian-American food. But I thought some of these dishes, when they're done well, they're really delicious, and so I used my mother's ground meat stuffing for the stuffed shells and a fresh sauce, and they really were delicious, and so I wanted to include recipes like that. When I started working on this book, I was a little bit skeptical because, of course, if there's one food that people know about Italian cooking, it's pasta, and I don't know how many pasta books are already out there. I haven't counted. So I wanted to make sure that I was going to do something different. I didn't want to focus just on regional pastas and go from region to region to region. I didn't want to just focus on the classic dishes that everybody knew. I wanted to present pasta in a new way, in a contemporary way, but I still wanted to pay tribute to some of these recipes that we all love. So I tried to make it an eclectic mix and to get people to see how broad the world of pasta really is. Fresh pasta, but it's also dried pasta. And now at supermarkets and grocery stores, we can get really good dried artisan pasta. It's a little more expensive than the mass produced, but relatively speaking, it's still fairly inexpensive. And there are just countless ways to sauce it. You don't ever have to make pasta the same way twice.
And who's that? Was that the Rusticella?
Yeah, Rusticella.
Mm-hmm.
It's Abruzzo, right?
Yeah,
we visited him and we interviewed him. And he was talking about his grandfather made, I don't know, like a dozen or less pasta shapes. And now every region has its own favorite, and everybody wants to have their own kind of pasta, and he now makes hundreds.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing about cuisine. It's always evolving. So even in Italy, where there are regional specialties, and you can go to almost any country restaurant in Abruzzo, and you'll find maccheroni alla chitarra, the regular abruzzese. But people
you need
are
that
always,
machine. You need that.
You need la chitarra. Although I did cut my square-cut noodles using my little hand crank Atlas. I mean, I just tested all the fresh pasta recipes in the book with my little hand crank Atlas machine.
Really?
And for the macaroni alla chitarra, I just rolled the sheet out a little bit thicker so that when you put it through the cutters, it comes out as a square-cut noodle.
Uh-huh. That's great, yeah. Let's look at this. Did you see that book, by the way, which was so simple, I wish I had thought of it, Geometry of Pasta?
I have seen that, and I keep meaning to get it.
I have seen it. It's not beautiful like your book. It's black and white. It just has drawings of shapes.
Which I think is wonderful.
Oh, yeah.
It's a wonderful categorization. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so anyhow, but your showstoppers, I think that if people buy this book and they turn to this, they're going to be introduced to recipes that they're going to be inspired by, and I'm sure that it's not routine pasta. Tell us about Joe Gray's duck egg fettuccine with pickled ramps, poached chicken thighs, and pesto.
Yes.
I can assure you my Nona never made that.
And neither did mine. And what's funny is Joe and I used to work together when I was a newspaper reporter at the Detroit News, and he is now the food editor at the Chicago Tribune. And I think he posted on Facebook one day about making this duck egg fettuccine with poached chicken thighs and ramps, and I just thought, wow, never in a million years would I put together these ingredients. And I was kind of intrigued, and I happened to just have started working on the pasta book, so I asked him if he wouldn't mind sharing the recipe with me, and he did. And I have never put chicken in my pasta. I think it's sort of like putting pineapple on pizza. It's just, please don't do it, you know?
My mother used to make for our son, she used to do with the pasta, the red sauce, she used to do meatballs, pork, and chicken.
Yeah, and I mean, my mother, I do put chicken in my meatballs, ground chicken, and sometimes even when I'm making ragu, I will now put a little bit of chicken meat in there, chicken thighs, because they're so flavorful.
Yeah, that's what
but
we used to.
But I don't like pieces of chicken in pasta. It always seems a little bit incongruous to me, but I made this recipe, and it was really lovely. And even Joe explained that pesto, a summer ingredient, and ramps, a spring ingredient, really are, you know, you would never see them together in Italy. But, of course, you can freeze pesto now. And so I tried his recipe, and I really loved it. And I decided I was going to include it because it's an example of somebody's imagination and somebody's whimsy. And I think that's the wonderful thing about home cooking and the way that cooking evolves. I have a recipe in the book called BLT Bucatini. Well, you would never see that in Italy either. But I use pancetta for the bacon and arugula for the lettuce, and somehow works. But the showstopper chapter, I just really tried not to separate recipes that contained dried pasta and recipes that contain fresh pasta, because I didn't want people to feel intimidated by recipes with fresh pasta, because they can be very simple to make. But these recipes in the showstopper chapter are really quite extraordinary, and I wanted to highlight them, and that's why I put them in a separate chapter. One that I really want to mention is the macaroni alla molinara d'uomo.
Oh, yeah, now that has a good story, so why don't you tell us that?
Yeah, well, and I told you that I spent my summers on the coast of Abruzzo when I was growing up, but when I went back in 2009 to research this book, my family and I ended up staying in this little house that we rented through the internet in a corner of Teramo, which is just a little section of province in Abruzzo. And we found the little house. It was like way deep in a valley, away from any town. And I just thought, this is so inconveniently located. I'm never going to be able to find what I need. It takes us 20 minutes just to get out of the valley and another 10 minutes to get to the closest town, which was Bisanti. And so I was a little bit discouraged because we had rented the house for a week. And so in town the next day, we ended up being introduced to a number of people, including this gentleman who was from Bisanti and happened to just know everything about the food of the area. And he started mentioning restaurants and places that we should go to, many of them actually way out in the hills and up mountains. We really needed to be accompanied to these places because they're not really anywhere you could find on your GPS. And he offered to take us around. He was just wonderful. And he described this one dish, macaroni alla molinara, and he described it as this long noodle, this basically this big ball of dough that is stretched to, I guess, 10 feet in length. And as he was describing it, I thought, I'm missing something in translation. I've never heard of this pasta. I'm from Abruzzo. So he took us to the restaurant where there's a cook who specializes in this noodle, and she gave my daughter and me an impromptu lesson and taught us how to make it. It's a noodle that dates back to, I think, the 13th century. And this area that we were in is called Valle Fino, and it used to be dotted with flour mills. So the name of the pasta is macaroni alla molinara, the miller's wife's pasta. And so it's basically a very pliable dough that's made with flour and a good bit of tepid water and a couple of eggs. And you take a tennis ball-sized piece of dough and you flatten it and poke a hole in it like you would maybe a bagel. And then you start stretching it with your hands. And once it gets too long to stretch and you've got this big loop, you put it on your countertop and you start working your way around the loop, and the more you roll, the longer this loop gets. And you'd think it would be an incredibly difficult thing to do, but my daughter, who was, I think, 11 at the time, got the hang of it pretty quickly. And so once you've got your noodle rolled out to about the thickness of your pinky finger, and it's maybe, it would be 10 feet in length end to end, you just coil it and dump it in boiling water, and it cooks for about 15, 20 minutes because it's a rather thick noodle. And then you just sauce it very simply with a meat-flavored ragu. And it is really one of the most extraordinary dishes I came across, and I had never heard of it. And I thought, things I love to do when I write cookbooks is to find these obscure recipes. I kind of think of myself as a curator of these recipes that I don't ever want to see vanish.
Yeah, so, well, I mean, I wish this wouldn't, but I would wish that you would come and make it for me rather than I would make it. But wouldn't it be funny to do a, it would be fun to have a party where what you did was you all got together and made this dish.
Yeah, it is a lot of fun. And I mean, I can see a number of people around the table, each with their own ball.
Exactly.
Rolling it out, yeah.
We ought to do that, Domenica. Let's promise that we'll get together and do this.
I would love to.
Well, listen, this is, I think people really should, I mean, just even for reading it and mouth-watering photos, it's packed with information. And it's totally different from your other book, which I think we're going to have to save for another time, Rustic Italian, which is a totally different subject.
Very simple, yeah. Everyday, fresh, seasonal recipes. That's what
good
you do on the weeknights, yeah.
But don't forget, listeners, The Glorious Pasta of Italy. And the author is Domenica Marchetti. And you've done an absolutely magnificent job with this book. I just love it.
Thank you so much.
Making me hungry.
Good.
Well, Domenica, thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure.
Stay with us because we'll be back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, sweetheart. What's up to close out today's program?
Well, it's yet another marvel of an Italian cookbook by a man who's not Italian, Ron Suhanowski, and it's called The Italian Table. And I think that everybody's going to delight in this book. Well, I hope I get this right, and I think I will. Ron Suhanowski, was that good enough?
Thank you so much.
Yes, and your background is Italian, and your whole family is too, although you have a good mixture of other great food cultures in there, Hungarian and Polish. Wow.
I do, yes.
But what you chose to write about, and I imagine that that's what you're going from the name of your line of restaurants, is you wrote The Italian Table, Eating Together for Every Occasion.
Yes.
And I was really interested in it because we get lots and lots and lots of cookbooks and lots of Italian cookbooks. And yet you took a different aspect of this, the idea of family and friends dining together and the significance of the table and people gathering around it. So how about explaining, certainly much more sharply than I just did, your overall concept and how you've organized this cookbook?
Well, and the one thing that I felt that all chefs take advantage of is the table and the fact that we create such great foods, whether it's very modern or contemporary or rustic, traditional. We forget about the fact that we need to have the table to bring the food to. And I realized that over my career that there were certain tables in my life that had influenced me in my career and created these amazing memories for me.
And the actual physical tables you're talking about.
And the actual physical, yeah, the actual physical tables. And essentially when I continued to think about it more and obsess about it, I realized that all recipes actually start with the table, because when we're at home cooking, we think about who we're cooking for, how many people, and they all have to come to the table in order to eat this food that we're creating. And in owning my own restaurants, I had noticed that with repeat customers, when they were bringing in family or new friends or the new people to the restaurant, they always would walk by a certain table and say, oh, I sat there for so-and-so's birthday, or I sat there the last time I came here, or had that pasta dish there at that table. And it made me think that most people's memories are based on the table that they sat at, and then they think about the food that they were eating at that table. So I really wanted to focus in on the aspect of the table, because that's something that we tend to take advantage of, and it helped me in formatting the book, because each table that has influenced me in my life had a specific number of people, which I organize each chapter as such throughout the book.
It's like almost a character in a novel, your table. Hmm?
Right, exactly.
Your line of restaurants, by the way, was Sfoglia, and you still have them in Nantucket and Manhattan?
I no longer have Sfoglia, no. Colleen and I sold our share of Sfoglia last year, and we have it both in New York and on Nantucket, and we have moved on to bigger and better things.
I mean, not restaurant work.
Not restaurant work per se, no.
Okay. How did you end up focusing in on cookbook writing?
How did I end up writing cookbooks?
Yeah, focusing on it. I mean, you have a number of them, haven't you? How many cookbooks have you done?
This is my second cookbook.
Oh, okay. So the other one I know about.
Yeah, the other one is Pasta Sfoglia. That was my first book, which is, that was published in 2009, and it won a 2010 James Beard Award, which
I'm
very excited about.
Yeah, okay. Now, back to the organization of the book and your tables. The chapters are, I'm going to say the name of the chapter, and you tell me the name, what the table is. Okay, chapter one, you say, really encapsulates your approach to the book, the whole book, and it's called Just Us.
Mm-hmm. That is our own table at home for our family, and meaning Colleen and I and our kids. And it's our Stephen Swift table. I happened to find it at a yard sale on Nantucket, and it surprisingly was actually carved by Stephen Swift himself. He signed it himself, and it's one of those things that will be an heirloom in our family, and we want to be able to hand it down. So it just sat us. It doesn't sit anybody else but us, our family. So it was the first one that I wanted to profile in the book.
Then we move on to having company.
And that's my grandmother's table. On my Italian side, my grandmother, Gardino, she had this table that I have actually obtained and I've had over the years. I still have it. And she had it off in the corner of her apartment, and we used to, well, she used to pick me up and bring me to her apartment, and she would make me an after-school snack, like creamed corn with crushed frazzles on top. But when she had company, unexpected company, she used to pull the table out, and the leaf would sort of slide out. It's one of those old porcelain tabletops that has a leaf that slides out from underneath it. And mm-hmm. just something that I remember as a kid, that I'd see it there in the corner sitting by itself all the time.
Okay, and then we have more company. We're moving on to serving 8 to 10.
And this is more about, this is not about a specific table, but about the concept of a communal table and having people join the table that are unexpected guests, friends of friends that you invite. You know, it always happens once or twice. And I really became fond of the aspect of communal dining, and we made sure that our restaurants had that element. It wasn't, not every table was communal, but we definitely had that element of having a communal table where locals or neighbors would be seated amongst each other and have thin dialogue and open conversation over good food and wine.
Then you have weekends, and I'm just going to run through the rest of them here. Sundays, celebrations, and then al fresco, which was also a special. It was on your porch, that table, right?
Yeah, that is, and it's at a house on Cape Cod that Colleen and I would go to. It's a family home that we often go to over the summer months, and we've had so many special sunset dinners there with family and friends, and dining al fresco is such a element of Italian cuisine in certain areas that I felt it was important for us to express that.
I want to say that actually in addition to the concept and how well executed the concept is and well taken the point is about the community and family, the recipes are delicious.
Thank you very much.
I was intrigued by, first thing, Colleen's gachata. We had, it's bread, but it just suddenly I understand reading that beans crushed or pushed down, squashed, I guess is the word I'm looking for.
It's like a squashed dough. You squish it down.
Yeah, because we talked a little bit about my Sicilian roots, and we had a bread called scaccia, which was really Italian bread, but it was a little flattened. It was stuffed with Swiss chard and cheese.
Mmm, that sounds delicious.
Yeah, but I never understood. Nobody in Italy has ever heard of it.
Well, you know those Italians, they make up stuff, and it changes so drastically from town to town that you don't even know. It could be the same thing, but each town has its own name for it.
Yeah, but I mean, I was wondering if it was the squashed down, because it was kind of, I mean, it was raised, but it had to be kind of flattened out to bake.
Yeah, it's scacciata is sort of where focaccia stems from. Yeah, focaccia, which sort of is a little bit thicker in texture and has more toppings on it than scacciata. Scacciata is just a flattened bread that has olive oil and salt on it. But yeah, it could be of the same family, but from town to town, each region has its own version of what scacciata is.
Well, there are a lot of dishes that somebody might think of as family meals, kind of meals, but there you always have an extra touch, like the Tuscan kale with shaved pears and crushed amaretto. Where did that come from?
Well, my sense of taste has always been fond of the contrast of sweet and salty or creamy and crunchy. I've always enjoyed that type of sensation when I'm eating food, and I became very fond of a style of Italian cuisine from the Renaissance where that sort of concept stems from, where they would put dried fruits and nuts all together in a savory dish. The concept, again, of sweet and salty together. So to take a traditional dish and add a little extra sophisticated touch that makes people think that or allows them to enjoy it on a different level. It could be the same. Nowadays, there's so many kale salads out there. Everybody has become fond of kale.
Tell me what this is. All of a sudden, I was raised on it, of course, but all of a sudden, everybody's writing recipes for kale.
Yeah, just the other day, actually, I was here in New York City. I was in Fairway Market, and I was checking out of the register, and I saw these bags of kale chips, and everybody's making kale chips now, and I thought, wow, that's so funny. Like, who would have ever known that now, all of a sudden, people are making kale chips, and it's a big thing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's amazing, kind of. You also have stuffed artichokes, and thought to myself, he's really lucky to have children who would sit down and eat some of these more demanding dishes. But then I remembered that our son, at age 4, his favorite food was a whole steamed artichokes.
No, I remember as a kid, my grandmother used to make stuffed artichokes, and it was such a treat to be able to eat the heart of the artichoke.
Oh, yeah.
It was like a very special thing if you got to eat the heart of the artichoke, because they were so far and few. Your grandmother never made stuffed artichokes for everybody. It was a limited batch of artichokes in the pot. And she had a specific pot that she would cook them in, and they would only fit like four artichokes. And whoever was really dying to have one, they were the lucky ones to have it.
Well, I must say that your recipe is almost exactly what I was raised on, so I'm fond of that, too. There are some things that are totally new to me. Like, I never even thought of roasted leg of lamb with plumped apricots and grated ricotta salata. I love all the ingredients, but I never thought, would never have thought of putting them together.
Well, you know, my way of thinking about the combinations of ingredients also stems from really thinking about what it is that you are cooking, like lamb, which lamb graze in salt marsh. It's a meat that demands salt, and so you want to serve salty things with it, and adding that contrast of sweetness to it really changes the complexity of it and makes it even more interesting. So that's kind of how I go about thinking about recipes and combinations of ingredients together.
Well, since it's a wonderful book, and I would highly recommend it for also recipes in depth for just about anybody. Anything else that you wanted to tell our listeners about the book?
Just, I hope that people can take the time to read through it. There's definitely a story that's woven throughout all the recipes, and there's reasons why these recipes were chosen for this book. And just know that it's a book that you can always go to for either a quick salad or a weekend meal if you're planning on something a little bit grander. But just know that from any degree, this book can be used, whether it's a quick meal for a weekday or, like I said, a Sunday get-together.
Yeah,
the book is very, very accessible, so I want everybody to enjoy it as much as they can.
Well, I'm sure that they will, and I'm sure that I will. And you should tell me where I can find Puntarella in this country.
Well, Puntarella is usually available, in this time of year. You kind of have to special order it. Sometimes you can find it in a local grocer specialty, but it's hard to come by.
Local farmers here grow it, they think, except they don't.
it's not quite the same thing. No.
Anyhow, Ron, thank you so much for telling us about the book or for writing the book, which we will certainly appreciate.
Thank you, Anne.
Well, there you have it, another On the Menu program. We're glad you joined us. We hope you'll join us again, same time, same place, as we celebrate Christmas Day together. And now from Miss Anne.
Bye-bye.